dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people whose intelligence about, well, the war for the free world and most anything I've come to respect more than our guest for this full hour of Secure Freedom Radio. His name is Robert Spencer. He is the author of 19 books, including most recently The Palestinian Delusion, The Catastrophic History of the Middle East Peace Process. It could hardly be more topical or more timely because just this week, of course, President Trump has unveiled the deal of the century, as he has described it, a vision for peace that is supposed to achieve what has eluded many of his predecessors, namely some real and enduring peace between Israel and the Palestinians. Robert Spencer, it is so good to have you, especially for the present purpose of trying to assess what the president has just launched and its prospects. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, my friend. Happy New Year. So what are we to make of what the president has launched here with the help of his son-in-law, Jared Kushner?
It's an extraordinary and audacious plan. It's one that will make the Palestinians look extremely bad when they refuse it, and they've already done that contemptuously, even calling for renewal of what they call the resistance and what those who are more informed call jihad terror attacks in response to it. And I think that may have been, because President Trump is no dope, that may have been his plan all along to show that there is no dealing with the fanatical intransigence that characterizes the Palestinian Authority leadership, as well as that of Hamas and Islamic Jihad.
And that's a key point, Robert, because we are often told, of course, that there is a profound difference between the jihadists of Hamas and Islamic Jihad and similar groups, Stripe, who now control absolutely part of the Palestinian community that has the misfortune to live in Gaza. But what about the so-called partner for peace that Israel was supposed to find in first Yasser Arafat and then Mahmoud Abbas and their leadership of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or Fatah?
Well, Frank, Obama called them the moderates and said that they were a good peace partner. And this is something that much of the Western world's leadership takes for granted, but it's not true and it's never been true. The Palestinian Liberation Organization, which of course controls the Palestinian Authority, and Fatah, which is an arm of the PLO, as well as Hamas and Islamic Jihad, are all dedicated to the total destruction of Israel as a Jewish state. Now, this is a bit deceptive, and a lot of people are taken in because the Palestinian Authority has recognized Israel's right to exist. But it also has to be noted, and fewer people are aware of this, that Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, he said it in 2014, that the PA, the Palestinian Authority, had not recognized and never would recognize Israel as a Jewish state. What they're saying is that the political entity that is Israel should be a Muslim Arab state joining the other Muslim Arab states in that area, but not that it should continue under the leadership of a government that is made up of non-Muslims. And this is a key distinction, because the whole imperative of the jihad worldwide, including the Palestinian jihad against Israel, is to destroy non-Muslim governments and replace them with governments ruled by Sharia or Islamic law. And Abbas, in saying that, made it clear that the Palestinian jihad is not about land or about settlements or about a state. It's about having Islam dominate and not be dominated, as Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, said.
meaning, in other words, the elimination of the Jewish state from territory that had once been controlled by Arabs, and that they believe, therefore, under the tenets of Islam, as you've documented so carefully in your 19 books, Robert Spencer, holds that once Islam owns the territory, it's theirs forever. But in this case, I just wanted to draw you out on one point, because the mendacity of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, when they professed to have recognized Israel's right to exist, is evident in what they did with the charter about the time that they were making that so-called recognition. Walk us through that, if you would, Robert.
Yes, the PLO charter actually says that there is no right, that Israel has no right to exist as a Jewish state. And this is very clear, that it's the Jewish nature of the state that they object to. It's not that the state can't exist as an entity on that land. It's that it has to be ruled by Islam, by Islamic law.
And as I recall, because this was a rather sticky wicket for Bill Clinton and his negotiators who were trying to fashion this deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians, that the charter had to be amended. But in fact, it wasn't actually altered to the effect of changing that fundamental principle for the Palestinian leadership. Is that right?
Yes. They declared that they recognized Israel's right to exist, which everybody took for granted as meaning that they recognized the Jewish state's right to exist, which, as I've explained, Abbas has explicitly ruled out. But they never actually changed the charter, which calls for Israel not to exist at all. It was just that they declared their intention to do so on several occasions. And this was all that was sufficient for Bill Clinton, as these kinds of assurances have been sufficient for so many other Western leaders over the decades. They are so anxious to cement a legacy that involves bringing peace to this intractable problem that they behave far more credulously than they ought to, and take at face value or assume that various statements of the Palestinian leadership mean things quite different from what they actually do mean.
This is, of course, the Palestinian delusion, of which you have written in your 19th book, The Palestinian Delusion, The Catastrophic History of the Middle East Peace Process. Robert Spencer, we have to take a brief break. When we come back, I want to drill down a bit further with you on the character of this delusion as it has mutated American policy to this point, and then ask you to compare and contrast, I guess, what Donald Trump has got in mind and its possible upshot. We'll talk about that and more with the great Robert Spencer, the director of Jihad Watch, which is required reading, jihadwatch.org. We'll be right back with more with Robert Spencer right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour with Robert Spencer, by my lights, one of the great students and teachers of Middle East affairs, and specifically the nature of Islam and the Sharia that is its doctrine, political, military, legal doctrine that governs the faithful and is intended to govern the rest of us. He is the author of 19 books, including most recently, The Palestinian Delusion, The Catastrophic History of the Middle East Peace Process. He blogs brilliantly at Jihad Watch, jihadwatch.org. He is an extraordinary resource and a good friend, and I'm always delighted to have him with us. And Robert, again, thank you so much for giving generously of your time today. We are talking about this so-called vision of peace that President Trump has put forward. And you mentioned that the Palestinian leadership, quote unquote, has rejected it. I'd like to just give our audience a flavor of the virulence of that rejection and what it says both about the leadership and about, you know, the prospects that any deal, this one or really any other that would have a remote prospect even of conducing to peace, is simply impossible as long as people like these lead the Palestinian community.
Yeah, absolutely, Frank. Mahmoud Abbas, of course, the president of the Palestinian Authority, now in the 15th year of his four-year term, he said the other day that he got a call from Trump and that he refused to pick up the phone. And he said that Trump was a dog, an SOB, a violent man who wants to force us into a program we're not interested in. Now, a dog, that's about the most serious thing you can call someone in the Arabic culture.
And that's mild, I guess, but not very, obviously, compared to what Hamas has been saying, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and even the Islamic State now is in the act. As I understand it, Robert Spencer threatening to engage in chemical warfare against Israeli settlements and population centers. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. The new caliph, the successor of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Quraishi, he said that, yes, the Jews in Israel and elsewhere should be attacked with chemical weapons. He called upon all Muslims worldwide to work to thwart Trump's peace plan. And he said that the Muslims who live in Palestine will be at the forefront of the jihad against the Jews and foiling the deal of the century.
This would be, needless to say, a mortal threat to the state of Israel, large numbers of its people. They're probably better prepared to deal with such a scenario than, well, we are, for example. And yet, it's unlikely that Israel is going to take these sorts of threats lying down. So is it your judgment, Robert Spencer, that the upshot of this whole exercise might be to actually inflame the situation, which has been relatively quiet now for a, you know, an environment and a situation that we've been endlessly told has to be resolved, has to be settled with some sort of peace deal, or, you know, all will be lost?
Well, there have been some analysts who said that Trump is only going to inflame the situation by releasing this peace plan, that it will offend the Palestinians and they will respond with terror attacks. And that's always possible, but it would be short-sighted and lack a historical perspective to blame that on Trump's peace plan. There's always a pretext for the jihad, because in Islamic theology, jihad can only be defensive right now since there's no caliph. If there were a caliph, the caliph could declare offensive jihad. In the absence of a caliph, all jihad has to be couched as a reaction to what the infidels have done. And so if it's not the peace plan, it's going to be something else that will be presented in the media in the Islamic world as being some terrible provocation that Muslims have to strike back with jihad against. At the same time, I think we also ought to remember that when the president declared that Israel's capital was Jerusalem and moved the U.S. embassy there, all sorts of analysts were saying that there would be a new and unprecedented wave of jihad terror attacks, and that did not materialize. The bark was far worse than the bite, and I think that it's very likely that that will be the case at this point as well.
Well, I certainly hope so, needless to say, and I'm not suggesting that the president shouldn't advance initiatives that make sense out of some fear that ISIS or Hamas or others might be unresponsive, shall we say. I'm simply saying that I believe that it says a lot about the character of the people who claim to lead and certainly exercise control over the Palestinian community. And I wanted to ask you, Robert, whether you know of any examples of what I assume is present in that community, namely people who don't want to continue to live the lives of this brutal repression under these PLO or Fatah or Hamas leaders, who would take the deal, who would welcome the opportunity to have the wealth and economic quality of life and so on that might flow from this deal. They simply, if they exist at all, don't exist in much numbers, presumably, but don't have any power. Would that be a correct characterization?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Frank. I'm sure there are such people, but I can't give you a single name because we're talking about extraordinarily repressive authoritarian regimes in both the West Bank, so-called Judea and Samaria, and in Gaza. The fact is that there is no political opposition that can possibly be formed that would be able to take that kind of a position. It would immediately be brutalized and victimized and likely murdered.
Indeed. And its family members and so on as well, of course. And evidence of this, Robert, but talk a little bit about this, because again, this is something that I find incredible and I think most of us don't have a clue about. The level of indoctrination, brainwashing, inculcation of a particular perception or whatever you want to call it, that goes on from the youngest levels of the Palestinian children on through the rest of the society as a matter of state policy. And until recently, using American aid to finance it, at least in part. What's up with that?
Well, it was not only financed by USA, but it was in UN schools, often with the knowledge of UN officials who approved of what was being taught. But this was a quintessential example of the authoritarian nature of the regime, because probably there's nowhere else in the world where children are so thoroughly indoctrinated into hatred and violence than in the Palestinian Authority, with the possible exception of North Korea. That's the level. You see little children on TV shows saying that their aspiration in life is to stab a Jew, and then they get applauded and congratulated.
And to die for Islam in the process, you know, to glorify martyrdom and so on. And if people have any doubt about this, not only is Robert Spencer's jihadwatch.org website indispensable, I also commend to you the Palestinian Media Watch website, which captures incessantly these kinds of videos that are being generated and the indoctrination that flows from them. It's truly shocking. And another of President Trump's quite commendable initiatives has been to say, we're not going to give you money any longer for this kind of purpose. Robert Spencer, let me ask you about another piece of this, and that is, you mentioned that Mahmoud Abbas is now in the 15th year of his four-year electoral mandate. How has that possibly been the case? Is that really on us, in part, at least in previous presidencies, that we sort of propped him up and kept him going because we feared what the alternative might be? Or what's the basis upon which this has persisted?
Oh, yeah, Frank, there's no doubt about it. The Obama administration actively worked to keep Abbas in power as the supposedly moderate alternative to Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the other more virulent jihad groups. The idea, as we discussed in the first segment, that Abbas is actually a moderate in any genuine sense is completely baseless. He's been a creature of the Western media in that regard, while enriching himself to an extraordinary degree, becoming a multimillionaire on siphoning off aid that was supposed to go to his people from Europe and from the United States itself.
It's so cynical and so reprehensible, and yet it's so endemic. And, you know, we hear all the time about friends of ours who are guilty of corruption or engaged in the diversion of funds and these sorts of things. And it seems as though it's often the case, if not uniformly so, that people like Mahmoud Abbas are given a complete pass for engaging this on a horrific scale.
He knows how to play the West. He knows how to play the media. He knows what to say to people like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. That is just what they want to hear. And so, you know, you there's nothing easier than deceiving people who want very much to be deceived. And he's a master at it.
Robert Spencer, we have to pause for just a second. When we come back, I want to tap your deep knowledge of Islam to discuss the wellspring of much of the problem here. And that is what I think of as Sharia supremacism. We'll get into that with the author of The Truth About Muhammad, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades, and The Complete Infidel's Guide to Iran, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back visiting for a very special conversation with one of the smartest people I know on matters involving the Middle East and Islam and, well, the kinds of existential threats to freedom that Sharia, this totalitarian code of authoritative Islam, represents, well, to both Muslims and non-Muslims alike. He is, of course, Robert Spencer, the author of 19 very important, very thoughtful, very informative books on these subjects, including, most recently, The Palestinian Delusion, The Catastrophic History of the Middle East Peace Process, about which we've been discussing with Robert over these past two segments. Let me turn, Robert, to a slightly broader focus, and that is how this Sharia supremacism, which we've, I think, made the case, is operating towards the destruction of the state of Israel, is also destroying Muslims around the world, or at least forcing them into a kind of submission and adherence to this program that's not good for them and certainly not good for the rest of us.
Well, Frank, if you look at photos from Egypt, from Afghanistan, from Iran in the 1960s and before, you will see the women not wearing hijab, dressed in Western clothes, being educated in schools and living their lives in ways that are much like the ways that women in the West live. But now, of course, if you take pictures of the same streets, you will see virtually all of the women in hijab or niqab or burqas in Afghanistan. And this is something that has been mandated by the Islamic, the Sharia police in Iran and by Islamic authorities in the other countries, as saying that a woman who does not cover her hair will dangle by it in hell and be burned, tortured for all eternity for not wearing hijab and so on. And in this kind of threats, these kinds of threats and intimidation have transformed those societies and others and made them into the authoritarian states that we see today. And so there is no doubt that many, many people, women and men, in those countries and in other countries all across the Islamic world, would like to be free of the rule of Islamic law as they once were. We can see this particularly in Iran, where the demonstrators recently have been being so bold, even in that violent authoritarian state, to chant, "We don't want the Islamic Republic," and "Down with the dictator," and so on.
Amazingly courageous, given what they are confronting in terms of lethal force being used to suppress them. Robert, I, as you were talking, I have to say I was bemused because, of course, you're right that those photographs describe a trajectory that has been really appalling for women, most especially in the Muslim world. But you mentioned that it's not that way in the West, only increasingly there are parts of the West in which it is the case that these same efforts to compel women and others, for that matter, to conform to the most severe of Sharia's dictates, are now operating as well. Talk a bit, if you would, about how that's happening. And I'd ask you specifically to describe for us the role that this organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, is playing in trying to dominate Muslim communities, as well as non-Muslim communities, for that matter, to this end.
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood is, according to a captured internal document, Frank, as you well know, the Brotherhood's plan for North America, it says that the brothers are engaged in a civilization jihad in the United States, which involves normalizing and mainstreaming various aspects of Sharia, such that Western people take for granted not only that Muslims will be practicing these things, but that they're good and proper, and that other people should practice them as well. One of the foremost examples of the success of this initiative is World Hijab Day, which was started by a Muslim woman who wears hijab and is Sharia adherent.
And the hijab, of course, is the head covering that is the most modest, I guess, or most, shall we say, the minimal of these various efforts to wrap Muslim women in this kind of garb of supposedly described as modest, right?
Yes, that's right. And she claimed falsely that Muslim women are subjected in the West, and in the United States in particular, to wholesale discrimination, persecution, harassment, and the like. And consequently, she called upon non-Muslim women to don the hijab, it's one day a year, and to go around wearing the hijab in solidarity with these supposedly persecuted Muslim women. Now, this has become a very popular event and has spread all over the United States and all over Western Europe. What's really bitterly ironic about it is that the only people who are really threatened with any violence in regard to the hijab are those who don't wear it, not those who do. In Muslim countries, there are many, many women. I have a long list that I publish from time to time and keep updated at Jihad Watch of women in Muslim countries who were threatened or even beaten and killed for not wearing the hijab. And that is something that I would never be able to make a complete list of, because most of the victims, we will never know their names and never know the circumstances, because it's taken for granted in many of these Sharia states in particular, but many majority Muslim countries as well, that it's perfectly legitimate and reasonable to brutalize a woman who would not wear such a thing. And so the number of victims is doubtless far, far greater than any genuine persecution of hijabis in the West. And yet the Western feminists are all about wearing the hijab and not about standing for women's rights.
We're speaking with Robert Spencer. He is a columnist for PJ Media and Front Page Magazine, as well as the author of 19 superb books, each and every one of which really is required reading. Robert, just to sort of bring this to a point that should be of particular relevance to each of us, how would you characterize the ultimate end state that the Sharia supremacists have in mind? Is it confined to the territories of Israel, of the Middle East, or lands that Muslims have once conquered, or is it truly universally ambitious?
It's a universal global vision. It is a vision to do nothing less, and I know this people find this unbelievable and they tend to dismiss it, but it is a vision to do nothing less than conquer the entire world. Now, of course, they're not going to conquer the entire world for Sharia, but many, many people can be brutalized or killed or their lives subjected to terrible suffering as they try to do this. But the imperative is universal and open-ended. Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, said, when you meet the unbelievers, then you offer them to invite them to accept Islam. If they refuse, invite them to pay the jizya, which is the sign of submission to Islamic law on the part of the non-Muslims. And if they refuse both, then seek Allah's help and fight them. So it's conversion, subjugation, or death. And that is the imperative that many Muslims will be following. As long as there are believers in Islam, there will be some who think that they ought to be doing this and waging war against unbelievers.
And that is obligatory. That's not something that is a sort of a la carte menu that you can choose or not choose. That goes with the program. So that brings me back to this point about, particularly in the West, and I think most especially in this country, the presence of Muslims who don't want to live under Sharia, who don't want to impose it on anybody else, and yet find themselves increasingly under coercive pressure from the Muslim Brotherhood, as you say, Robert Spencer, in that explanatory memorandum, which really is, again, required reading for people who want to understand what we're up against. This was an item that was introduced into evidence in the largest terrorism financing trial in U.S. history. And it was not meant for our eyes. It was providentially obtained, but it was written for the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood. We've had people, Robert, say that, oh, it was just sort of the musings or rantings of some individual and had no bearing on the true vision or tenets or purposes of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I'd ask you to speak to that point. But to the extent that victims, first and foremost, of much of this Sharia supremacism are Muslims, especially in the West, on the route to forcing the rest of us, as you say, to submit or convert or ultimately die, this is a struggle that I think really warrants close attention and our help to those who are resisting, to the extent there are any, the ambitions of the Brotherhood. What say you?
Well, it's important to note, Frank, that there are no significant Muslim organizations that have any kind of serious following among Muslims in the United States that actually are not linked to the Muslim Brotherhood. If you want to name every last one of them, the Council on American Islamic Relations, Muslim American Society, Islamic Society of North America, so on and on and on, they are all to the Brotherhood, either in this document or in other ways that it make it clear that these are not independent entities, but these are Brotherhood organizations that are dedicated ultimately to imposing Sharia. There is no Muslim organization of any significant size that is pushing back against this imperative.
And this is deeply troubling because there needs to be, and I think we ought to help foster them if we can. Robert Spencer, we have to take a pause. When we come back, I want to just visit with you about one of the other horrific manifestations of this Sharia supremacism, namely the persecution around the world of Christians by those who believe it is Allah's will that they be put to the sword or put to flight or otherwise set upon, and what we must do about that as well. That and more with Robert Spencer right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for our fourth and final installment of this really informative conversation with one of the great minds about the challenges of our time that we face from those who believe it is the will of Allah to use force or through whatever other means obtain our submission to their dictates. A pretty unsavory prospect when you look at what is being done to women, homosexuals, Jews, and others, including Christians, in various parts of the world in the name of Sharia. Robert Spencer, in your books, in your blog at jihadwatch.org, in your columns at PJ Media and Front Page Magazine, you often are calling attention to the suffering of people simply because they dare to follow Christ in areas in which Muslims have the ability to impose their will upon them. Talk a bit, if you would, about the magnitude of this problem at the moment. We had just this past week a report by a group known as Open Doors USA that had further shocking statistics, but I'd be interested in your take on the magnitude of this problem and the degree to which it is now truly a global phenomenon.
It's really extraordinary, Frank, how much the persecution of Christians is indeed a global phenomenon, and yet how universally and routinely ignored it is. Unfortunately, it is the case that there are 245 million Christians in 73 countries facing extreme, very high or high levels of persecution, according to Open Doors USA, the persecution watchdog.
Robert, that actually was last year's number. This year's number, released just this past week, is 260 million being heavily persecuted.
It just gets worse, and the indifference of the world is only making it go on and exacerbating the problem.
This brings me to a couple of questions, because the lack of interest in this is so stunning. I mean, we've just noted, memorialized the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, a moment that brought to an end some of the worst barbaric oppression of human beings by others in history. But what was done to the Jews in World War II, the Holocaust, pales by comparison to this onslaught against Christians, not entirely by Muslims, to be fair, but predominantly by them. And again, not all Muslims, but these Sharia supremacists. And yet, this isn't happening in some previous time, let alone ancient history. This is happening on our watch. So Robert Spencer, what do you attribute the fact that so little attention is given to this carnage, this catastrophe in our time?
I think, Frank, that Islamic advocacy groups in the United States, the same Muslim Brotherhood groups that we've been discussing, they have very skillfully, extraordinarily skillfully, played the victim card, played the race card, and gotten the left on board with their agenda. They understood very early on that the American left was particularly focused on victim groups, groups that were supposedly facing discrimination, persecution, and harassment, of course, some of which really were. And they began to couch their own efforts and their own opposition in those terms, so that you and I, of course, and many others were smeared as bigots and racists for opposing and exposing the Muslim Brotherhood agenda in the United States. And that is music to the ears of the leftist political and media elites. They fall for that kind of thing wholeheartedly without any critical thought. And so now it's leftist groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center that are the foremost exponents of this defamation.
Let me ask you, Robert, because you've put your finger on a critical problem, the red-green axis, as we've come to call it, of the hard left and the Islamists making common cause. They may have a different end state in mind, to be sure, but they're perfectly prepared to join forces for the purposes of taking out those who oppose them, whether they're on the right or whether it's America more generally or certainly Israel. The skillfulness is most evident, it seems to me, in a practice known as interfaith dialogue, which the Muslim Brotherhood has, I think you're right in saying, perfected as a technique for sort of obscuring what they're really doing and enlisting the help of others in securing concessions or submission. The most recent and dramatic example of this, and I just want you to sort of walk us through it because you have studied so deeply and so extensively the truth about Sharia and its practice by authoritative Islam. This so-called Abrahamic Faith Initiative is something that I have been really struck by. Could you just explain, in the shortest of forms, obviously, the deceptiveness, really, of this idea that you have in Judaism and Christianity and Islam, essentially all one big happy family, with slight variations in terms of some of the central tenets of their faith, but it's basically all, you know, one God and all playing for the same team?
Well, Frank, the easiest way is to go to the Quran. The idea of the Abrahamic Faith Initiative is that we are all united in being the children of Abraham, and that we should focus on what unites us rather than what divides us. That sounds wonderful. So let's go to the Quran, chapter 60, verse 4, and we see Abraham himself telling his father, there is enmity and hatred between us and you forever until you acknowledge that Allah is the only God. And so the Quran is saying that Abraham says, we're going to hate you until you become Muslim. Now, people will say, wait a minute, how is Abraham a Muslim? Well, he is in the Quran. In the Bible, Abraham is the father of many nations. But in the Quran, he's saying that you have to hate even your relatives if they're not Muslim.
Yeah. Another anomaly, it seems to me, is the role that Jesus plays in the Abrahamic faith known as Islam. Could you just briefly explain what is the character of Jesus, according to Sharia adherent Muslims, and the particular duty that he has at the end of times?
Well, to highlight the deceptiveness of the whole enterprise, I should point out that around Christmas time every year, there are Muslims, Ibrahim Cooper has an article that circulates every year, and there are others who write about how the Christianity and Islam have so much in common because Muslims revere Jesus. And that's true if that's where you stop. But in reality, in Islamic theology, Jesus is the foremost critic of Christianity. He was not the savior of the world, not the son of God, does not rise from the dead. And at the end of the world, he's going to come back and destroy Christianity, break all the crosses, which means destroy Christianity as we know it.
And the Jews, too, for good measure. And the reason for that, as I understand it, is that that's because the Jews and the Christians did not recognize Islam as the one true faith.
Yeah, in chapter 61, verse 6 of the Quran, Jesus says that after him is coming Ahmed, or that is Muhammad, and that the Jews and the Christians should accept him, which of course they did not.
Robert Spencer, we've only scratched the surface with you, and yet I think we've established on so many of these fronts much to be troubled by, specifically this insidious political warfare that has been waged against us to inure us to this present danger, truly, of Sharia supremacism in our midst. It will prevent, I'm afraid, any kind of real peace between Israelis and Palestinians, and it does indeed pose a threat to Christendom, both in Europe and here. I appreciate so much your scholarship, Robert, your brilliant writing, your tireless productivity, and your willingness to share the insights as you do so well from time to time with us here. I hope it'll be often in 2020, and thank you for your time today. God bless you, my friend, and congratulations again on the publication of the splendid new book, The Palestinian Delusion, The Catastrophic History of the Middle East. We'll talk with you soon. Robert, we'll talk with the rest of you, I hope, again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.